G'day. Welcome to the Financial Bloke Podcast, the podcast for people seeking the wisdom needed to grow their family's wealth and live a happier, healthier, and more prosperous life. My name's Ben Law, and I am the Financial Bloke. Welcome back to the Wealth and Wisdom Podcast. I'm Ben Law, and I'm your host. Today's going to be a cracker of an episode. We're going to be talking about ambition versus patience, the failure paradox, the relationship between taking risk and ultimate success, and the power of mentors and developing a solid network. All the things you need to know if you want to achieve your version of success. So you might be thinking, who are you going to be talking to today, Ben? Well, I get to meet a lot of both successful and interesting people in my line of work. But once in a while, I get to meet someone who really impresses me. It's not often that this happens, but when I met our guest today, it was one of those times. She's humble and might not like me saying any of this, but I don't subscribe to the tall poppy syndrome, and I personally like to celebrate the strong-valued, hard-working, smart, but humble people like Tess. Tess Cam is in her early 30s, but has packed in and achieved a lot in those 30-odd years. She grew up in a cattle station near Rockhampton in Queensland. She was the 2012 Edgar Huggins Memorial Scholarship winner, the 2013 Cattle Council of Australia Rising Champion in Beef State winner. She completed a business degree, and she's also a Nuffield Scholar. She's a quick but deep thinker, which in my experience is a rare combination. She was most recently the general manager of Signature Beef, and now she's joined her husband in driving their own rural production business. So without further delay, strap yourself in. Welcome, Tess.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, Tess. Now, where we want to start off with the first question is, now, for everyone listening, can you just give us a quick summary of your background so we can get an idea of who you are and what you're all about?
Yeah, great. So I grew up on the land as a fifth generation beef producer. And honestly, I had the best childhood growing up between a feedlot on the Darling Downs and various cattle stations throughout central and north Queensland. I got to cruise around with my animals, whether I was driving vehicles or playing in a pile of cotton seed or grabbing my horses and going on adventures. It was truly the best place to grow up. And that connection with animals led me to competing in some like junior cattle shows and camp drafts, and took me to an arena where I saw there was a wider world out there. And through school and afterwards, that led me to an exchange program to the States, then on to university. At uni, I studied a Bachelor of Business Management at UQ, and from there, I stepped into a role with Signature Beef and took a dive off the deep end into the world of processing. And that took me on a career trajectory from sort of a production coordinator to into a little bit of sales. And as I grew and learnt in the role over a period of years, stepped into a role of general manager and essentially taking that company through a period of growth over a 9-year period.
Fantastic. And you also forgot to mention, I think you're the oldest of 6 children, aren't you?
That's correct. So eldest of 6 in a big, beautiful family at Mystery Park. So they inspire me so much, just seeing my younger siblings, the things that they kind of, the way they see the world and the questions they ask, it certainly keeps me on my toes and inspires me to keep showing them different paths of what's possible for them.
And also too, you will have learnt some amazing patience and also probably communication skills over the time.
No, there's nothing quite like being in a big family, and especially while I was the eldest by a little bit growing up, now that they're all getting bigger and stronger and older, I can't quite use the same, you know, physical dominance that I could when my brothers were like 10, 11, 12. Now I've got to be really nice to them.
Well, they're lovely. I know them all, so they're all lovely. So I'm sure that wouldn't be too hard to do. So okay, Tess, now where I'd like to dig in here is we're going to have a great conversation today. I'm really looking forward to this, but you're 32 years of age, and I think you've undersold yourself a little bit in your intro, but you've achieved a fair bit over that time, and you're about to get married. I think it's only a few weeks away, so a big congratulations.
Thank you.
And you've had an amazing career with Signature Beef, and now you're on your own journey to farming success. And so it's very clear to me that you're driven and absolutely willing to have a crack at something outside your comfort zone. And so my first question, I suppose, would be is, have you always been a driven individual? And if you have, how have you balanced that drive with patience? You know, patience to know that eventually you'll get to where you want to go.
Yeah. For those who know me well, I don't think they'd list patience in my, you know, top qualities, but it's certainly one you learn the hard way. But like for as long as I can remember, I've always been the kid that, you know, wrote down little to-do lists and, you know, would write out plans and dreams and schemes and really that cookie cutter type A personality. I really loved, even from a young age, I loved the high that you got from achieving a goal, but also the internal reflection that you get from not achieving a goal or things not planning out how you planned, which happens to me more often than not, but that's growth and that's learning. So I guess I've always, growing up, my parents, my grandparents, aunts and uncles, from my perspective as a child, they always appeared to be doing big things. They sort of, the conversations were always quite visionary in my mind. So I guess I was raised with a growth mindset. But on the flip side, I also understood that to achieve those things, you had to have a plan and you had to work at it. It wasn't just going to magically be delivered to you. So I guess ambition's the byproduct of seeing those bigger visions and wanting to achieve them. So for me, that's looked like my career progression with Signature Beef. It's looked like my fiance, or soon to be husband, and I, on weekends, we knew we wanted to, you know, one day live on land of our own. So that looked like the best way we could think of to do that at the time was on weekends. We started buying cattle out of sale yards and we sourced some adjustment. We were fortunate to have an opportunity to put cattle on adjustment at my parents' property and then further afield. And so our Friday nights would look like unloading road trains from, you know, Charter Stowers or wherever and inducting trade cattle on a Saturday morning, smiling sweetly at local vets to preg test on a Sunday and squeezing that all in between our day jobs. And doing that over a period of years allowed us to build the dream that is Catalyst Grazing. And about 18 months ago, that allowed us to buy our first property, which is one goal that both Pat and I have been incredibly proud of. Yeah.
It's fantastic. That's a common thread amongst entrepreneurs and people that are really driven is a lack of patience. And I remember as a kid, I quite often used to get called Bullet Gate Benny. I was always trying to go quicker than I probably should have. And it's something that I really struggled with was balancing drive with patience. And I can't remember who said this, Tess, so I'm not going to even try and quote it, who it was, but it was something along the lines of most entrepreneurs aren't patient enough to be successful. And so a lot of people, you know, they get a full head of steam, they set their goals, they want to get somewhere, and then they get the first few setbacks, and then all of a sudden they lose steam or they lose interest and find something more shiny and excited down the track. And so that's what I was, you know, digging into there. So if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just in reading various kind of theories and books, et cetera, there's obviously the school of resilience and endurance and grinding hard at something until it happens. So I kind of put that on one sticky note on the wall, and then there's kind of this world of being patient and also just, I guess, not wishing it into existence, but allowing it to happen in its own time and going, you know, do I need to, you know, stop trying to force this and just take a step back and let things fall into place. So I sort of, those two juxtaposing views, sit them on a sticky note beside each other on the wall. And as you walk past it, you go and you're thinking about an issue or a problem and you go, what rein do I need to pull here? And I'm not sure I always pull the right rein, but it is fun to be aware of those two different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the paradox of the two, isn't it? I like that. So do you have multiple post-it notes sitting around your house, do you, on the walls?
I'm a visual person, Ben, so unfortunately, yes. And then when you have guests coming over, you kind of run around pulling the post-it notes down because if they read them, they'd think you're insane.
Well, Tess, my office looks like a Muppet's vomited in here. I would say there'd be close to 150 to maybe 200 post-it notes floating around my room. Someone told me a long time ago, they said, Ben, you've got a lot going on in your head. The best way to deal with that is to write it down on a post-it note, stick it on the wall and move on. And I used to, my team, when I had the financial advice practice, used to laugh. They'd come in and go, what's the new post-it note today? And it was just a great way of keeping things front and center and being able to get it out of your head. Okay, so Tess, what I want to go on to now is, you know, when you're driven, like you said before, is if you want to be successful in life, you have to take risk. And there is a real relationship between risk-taking and success. And so, in your opinion, do you think someone can, you know, be successful, achieve their goals and get to where they want to go without taking on significant risk? And do you think they're actually inherently intertwined?
Yeah, good question. I'm just even thinking as you ask it, breaking down each of the elements into, you know, because everyone's got such a different kind of perception or interpretation of both risk and success. So, I mean, for me personally, it's taken a really long time to get comfortable with the concept of whether you want to call it failure or even just not succeeding the way you thought you would. And in saying that, I mean, I've been, if you look at my CV on paper, I've been so very fortunate to be involved in some wonderful programs and scholarships, such as that one I mentioned earlier that took me over to the States, the Hudgens Scholarship or Nuffield, et cetera. But equally as high and not written on paper as, you know, the stack of scholarships and programs and that my application didn't even get a call back from. And that's okay. That's developing and learning and part of the process. And, you know, it's comes down to, I think, how big of a pond you're comfortable in swimming in. Do you want to be the biggest fish in the smallest pond or do you want to feel what deep seas feel like? And sometimes that looks like not succeeding or playing at a level that you're maybe not ready for yet, but it helps you level up over time. And Ben, in a chat you and I had a little while ago, I feel like you nailed it with the concept of that radical personal responsibility and asking yourself, how did I contribute to my current situation? And for me, that's been a really powerful thought when it comes to, you know, moving through mental blocks or problem solving a situation. Or on the flip side, allowing in those moments of joy or success to feel the fulfillment because you accept that I got myself here. And I find that such a cool and simple question just around success. But then on the counter, when it comes to risk, I believe risk is really relative to your skill set or experience. And that might be also defined by your appetite for risk. So Pat and I, when we're trading, we've got completely different appetites for risk, but have a mutual respect for where each other are coming from. So when I look at a trade, I want to go 150% in and go, you know, you've got to go big to get big. And Pat's considering all the factors and going, oh, well, I'd be comfortable going in at maybe a 50% level, but I think we should, you know, hold 50% as a buffer. And we're yin and yang back and forth. And his perspective has helped us make so many better decisions. But likewise, I think my appetite has also driven us forward in places where, you know, he might have taken a more conservative approach. So I think risk is a really relative and personal piece. But I didn't really answer your question around, you know, the relationship. So for me, I think it maybe comes back to the concept of courage when it comes to if risk and success are interlinked.
You're absolutely right around risk-taking. It's all relative. For some people, quitting their job and starting a business, they could never even possibly consider that. You know, it's just not in their risk. And yet other people can go borrow $50 million and be quite comfortable with that. So it is definitely, you know, very, very person-specific. But I think also too, as you get older and you take more risks, you can increase your risk tolerance. Now, for some people, that's bad because they're already very high risk takers and they go to the next level and that's when things come unraveled. But for those people that maybe haven't grown up in a world where they've been exposed to bigger thinking, more complex goals, taking little small risks to start with can be really important to increase your risk tolerance. And absolutely, I totally agree on success. Success is very subjective. depending on who you are. For some people, they have big business goals. Other people have, you know, very small business goals, but they're happy as Larry with that. So you've got to figure out what does success look like for you, remembering that sometimes the worst risk is the doing nothing risk. So, you know, what I mean by that is you get to 80, you get to 90, you get to the end of your life and you look back and go, holy dooly, I never took enough risk. And they always say that it's far better to regret the things you've done than the things you haven't done. And I think that's a really important point for young people to realize. And the reality is whatever your definition of success is, if you want to get it, you're going to have to take some risks and get outside your comfort zone. And that's where it all becomes powerful.
Absolutely. I like that concept. What you said earlier really resonated with me about, you know, you've got to take those little risks and build up that kind of, it's almost like that belief in yourself or self-confidence from making those little decisions or taking those little risks and proving your own capacity to yourself. And I love how genuine that self-confidence that comes from that process is because you see yourself achieving that. So no one else or no situation can take that away from you. It's truly yours.
Absolutely. And you build on your confidence. Yeah, very few people wake up and are born with an innate amount of confidence in every single area. You know, there's always areas that we don't feel confident in. So, you know, the only way we can do that is to start taking the risks, dealing with failure and then moving forward. And that's where I want to head into next, if that's okay, Tess, is, you know, we touched there on failure. And I think it'd be fair to say that pretty much everyone fears failure and most people will do anything to avoid it. Now, I disagree with that concept. I think failure is just feedback. But I want to consider the fact that, you know, if you want to achieve anything worthwhile in your life, I believe you have to take risk. You know, that could be as simple as, you know, if I want to find the man or the woman of my dreams, I have to take the risk to go up and ask them out on a date. Or if I want to buy that first house or farm, I've got to borrow some money. You know, I've got to take those risks. But more often than not, it may lead to failure. Now, in your experience, you know, how do you see failure in your world and how would you define it and how do you deal with it? And what's your perspective?
It's a fun question, Ben, because for me personally, it's certainly been an evolution. I was definitely the kid and the teenager who feared failure like the proverbial. Going through university, I failed a handful of subjects and it felt like the world was ending. And, you know, in hindsight, I'm not recommending to do that. I certainly, you know, it was certainly within my control to do better, but life happens. But like you said, everyone's got such a different definition of failure. I mean, a few years ago, I embarked with my family on a mission to train for an ultra marathon, and they had a really fun way through that sort of nomination and training process the event was Ultra Trail Australia. And being such a big challenge, it offered a very unique perspective on failure because, you know, for some people at the elite level, their definition of failure was coming second or third in the race. They didn't win it. And, you know, for others, it was, you know, if they were in the front pack or, you know, in the gold medal time or silver medal time slot, they were, you know, that was success. But if you're at the back of the pack, that was failure. And for me, fronting up to the start line was, you know, my definition of success. So in my mind, failure would have been not doing the training and not making it there. So I think it all comes down to what kind of race you're running. And I think it's that feeling of, like, for me personally, it's failure for me is when I feel like I've let myself down. It's when I haven't been prepared or haven't performed as well as I know I can. That sort of that sinking feeling of, you know, not having that jittery high of, whew, I did that, I had a crack. When you don't have that feeling, that's sort of where I walk away from it going, okay, I need to, you know, let's not do that again. Let's run away from that feeling. That's what it feels like for me.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I mean, I know when I went through uni, I failed a couple of subjects early on and it was fantastic feedback for me because it just showed me that, hey, you just can't go partying and having fun all the time, 18-year-old Ben. You've actually got to do some work. And so it was great feedback. And I think it was Thomas Edison that someone asked him once, you know, how did you deal with the failure when you were trying to make the light bulb? I'm sure it was Thomas Edison. I'm probably going to get it wrong and make an idiot of myself. But anyhow, such is life. I'm happy to fail. And I remember someone asked him that, and I think without paraphrasing, it was something along the lines of, I haven't failed, I've just found 2,000 ways that won't work. And I love that. I just think whatever you decide you want to achieve that's worthwhile in life, it's not going to come easy. It's not going to happen overnight. And it's going to probably take a whole lot of feedback to be able to adjust your course and then get stuck back in again. And if you don't quite get to where you want to, it's adjust your course again. And, I mean, children do that beautifully. I mean, if you've ever watched a toddler try and walk, I mean, they don't get up, fall over and then go, I'm never going to do that again. They get up, they adjust, I should put my foot in front of the other one, I need to hold onto a chair, whatever it might be. Children are so good at dealing with that. But when we become adults, we seem to just get to the point where we won't deal with it.
Yeah, correct. And in that light, it's almost like sometimes success isn't figuring out how to do it. It might be, you know, weeding out a few ways of what you don't want to do or, you know, ways of not doing it. And that could narrow the field a little bit. And sometimes that's a step forward and you marinate on it again and pick it up again at a later date.
But listening to you, I agree with the whole, if you don't have a crack, that's more of a failure in my eyes. If you really want to do something and you don't give it a good hard go or you half-ass it, I think that's a failure. And then at the other side is if you don't take the lessons, so you do not get the result you expect, well, then, you know, you need to learn the lesson off it. And if you don't, then you've wasted that lesson.
Yeah, agree.
Now, Tess, you said when we were chatting the other day, you said you gave me this great quote and I've used it twice now. Yeah, I loved it. It's on one of my post-it notes on the wall. It's stuck on the wall there. I loved it. And it was about the surgery. And I remember us talking about the fact that, you know, when you're getting from A to B on a project and you start off on this goal, you know, I want to own my first property or I want to trade cattle or I want to invest off farm or whatever it might be, before you get to that success point or where you've hit the point where you're happy, there's a lot of points in the middle that don't look like success. And I think, and I'm going to hand it back to you, but you know the quote I was going to say about the surgery?
Yeah. So I think I, as a throwaway comment, said, halfway through surgery, it looks a little like murder. And it's a graphic but visual way of, trusting the process. And I feel like I'm, you know, in a few elements of life, I'm very much in the halfway through surgery process, but it's a fun way of giving yourself grace to trust the process and go, you know, sometimes you've got to shake things up a little to achieve a different endpoint. Mm.
And accepting the fact that, you know, like with surgery, at some stage it's going to look pretty messy and not quite exactly like you want it to be, but if you have faith in the future and you do all you can, well then, you know, you're on the right path. Okay, now the next part I wanted to duck into here, Tess, and I think you've got bucket loads of this, but there's been times in my journey personally where I've had to really dig deep and drive through, you know, pain and adversity. So, you know, potentially failures, just things getting tough. Now, for you, have there been moments when you've questioned the path you're on or even considered giving up? And from your point of view, how did you find the resilience to keep going?
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure if I just rosily, you know, sail through and not kind of, you know, dwell on the bad moments. Or when I think about, you know, you read the autobiographies and you see the people who have been through so much hardship and hard times, et cetera, and I go, oh gosh, I feel like I've lived a very, very fortunate life in terms of we work hard, but we, you know, we've been able to overcome everything that's been in our path. So, but in saying that, like when I stepped into the role at Signature, it was a massive learning curve. And when you're dealing with third-party processing and so many different moving parts and such a wide range of customers and a very small team, the challenge list at the start of the day seemed insurmountable a lot of the time. But I don't know if there was actually, in hindsight, looking back, I don't know if I look back and go, oh, that was a really, you know, I really define that time as a failure or insurmountable. And when I reflect on that a little bit, I think it felt bigger than me. So growing up, my grandfather, he had this wonderful characteristic of being able to give us this task to do, whether it was picking up a vehicle from down the paddock that we didn't know how to start or you know, achieving this, you know, seemingly insurmountable task. But you had so much respect for your elders that you didn't dare question what was being asked of you. So when I was in the early days of the role at Signature with Blair and Josie, it was they'd, you know, ask me to purchase a mob of cattle or reach out to this customer, and I'd sort of look at the task at hand and have absolutely no idea on how I was going to achieve it. But I had the admiration and respect for the role, and that it felt like if they had asked me to do that role, it felt like it was in, even though me as Tess didn't feel like I knew how to do it, I felt like the person who was sitting in that chair doing that role would know how to do it. So there was almost like this mask of confidence that I could put on. And from that, you sort of, you figure it out, and you're just, you know, whether you're Googling how to go about something, or you just rip the Band-Aid off and ask what needs to be asked, et cetera, you go through those problem-solving thoughts and process. And then when you achieve a desirable outcome, that's a little rep, a little tick that you get with yourself. And all of a sudden you build this confidence and capacity from that. It begins to snowball and it becomes bigger than you. So that was really a pivotal kind of, being able to identify that process really helped for me define what resilience felt like. But I guess in a bigger sense, there was one situation that we had quite a few years ago at SIG. It's a bit of a funny story now that it all worked out.
I love funny stories. Go for it.
It was in the peak of demand for Aussie beef into China. I think it was about 2016. And we were getting 10, 20 inquiries a day for high quality, low price Australian beef into China. And anyways, you sift through the inquiries and find out who the real customers are that actually have shops or distribution networks. And anyways, we met with this one company, back and forth over a few emails, even some face-to-face meetings. They came down to the abattoir for a production. And growing up with cattle, I had a fairly intimate knowledge of, you know, just how all the muscles worked and how the relative cutting lines that they sort of broke down into, and sort of working back and forth with the customer about, you know, how they were using the product and just figuring out, you know, what the best cutting lines and the best, I guess, packaging style, because there's an endless variety available, so that we could kind of get to a price point and a, you know, portion size, which would decide the size of the cattle we were processing and all those technical bits. And anyways, we came up with a, you know, I think it was a 3-container contract. And the particular mob of cattle we were wanting to use for it, there had been a embargo in place on Aussie beef into China for a couple of months period at this time. So we'd had some cattle on feed for a little longer, and so we wanted to process them very specifically for this contract. So it was a bit of a, this was our one shot for this mob of cattle. We processed them, everything went well at production, and we were getting ready to get the container to port, and just a few questions started popping up that weren't quite making sense. And this company who we'd taken on board as a customer was starting to act like an agent and asking for kickbacks, et cetera. Anyways, we went on a journey for about 9 months of, it ended up in the end, of back and forth emails, letter of credits, and all sorts of banking loopholes. Anyways, I think it was about 270 something days later, we received full payment for the beef, and it was worth about $250,000 or something, the contracts were. So it was a significant amount of money, and the beef was cut in a way that it wasn't, you know, easily resaleable for full value on the Australian market. So for me, that was, looking back, that's probably one moment of, whew, that felt like a resilience moment in those years at SIG.
Sounds like you, it's a never say die thing with you, Tess. It sounds to me like you believe in your ability to survive and thrive once you get into, and then you have like a calm never say die attitude, which is, I'm just going to make this work. I'm going to figure this out.
I wouldn't say it was calm the whole way, but it was certainly a what was your other alternative sort of thing. So it was at each point you're making a decision, you're going, we know we've done the right thing here, so let's keep enduring. And that, when it's broken down into a step-by-step process, you don't sort of look out at the start and go, this is going to be a 270-day battle. You sort of, on a day-by-day, you go, yes, this is the right move.
Yeah. So taking the information that you get at every stage and then saying, what's the best information I can get? What's the best decision I can make with the information to hand and then moving forward with it. And I think, again, that just comes back to that, you know, most people aren't patient enough to be successful. Well, it sounds to me that whilst you say you don't have much patience, you do when you've when the dog's got the bone, it's not going to let go of it.
And then, yeah, applying it today, it's sort of, I think a very real one at the moment is just looking at, you know, how turbulent the commodity and livestock markets are at present, and certainly making a making for some difficult decisions for a lot of producers in terms of, you know, what do we do with this year's, you know, throughput, and how do we do the best thing by our business at the moment? So in my mind, resilience is really strongly linked to a healthy decision-making process, and finding that connection with, without sounding too corny, with your purpose and your why, and letting that really drive how and why you do things.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I'm a huge believer in having a strong why. That's what I believe builds resilience myself as well. So now, I don't know anyone that's achieved anything of real importance on their own, Tess. Most people have had lots of help. Now, have mentors, or it sounds to me like you've had mentors in your family, but have mentors been really crucial in your journey so far? And would you recommend, you know, that's a thing that young people should be really focusing on?
Absolutely, Ben. They're absolutely invaluable. I've been so fortunate to have some incredible mentors across a range of industries. Throughout high school, I was fortunate to be, you know, introduced to some very clever producers, seed stock breeders, meat scientists, etc., that were so generous with their time and consideration. And in a lot of those instances, particularly throughout, I guess, high school and my gap year, et cetera, that looked like me calling up someone that my parents knew, or this particular person that I'd read about. It looked like directly contacting them, which was a nerve-wracking process, but something that the benefit outweighed the discomfort a millionfold. So that kind of felt like a potentially one of your more formal sort of mentor-mentee relationships. You know, I was in high school and calling this person to ask if I could ask them some questions or come and help out on their farm for a week or an AI program or something. And then just as you were working alongside them, have the opportunity to, you know, ask questions or anything like that. But what I didn't know at the time, because I was just young, enthusiastic and excited to be looking at a different farm, was I was also delivering some form of value. I was, you know, I was running up and down helping them keep the crush loaded or whatever it was. It was a low skill set, but it was of value to them. So it felt like a when I was asking the questions or asking for advice or asking for a reference, it wasn't a one-way street. And even though I didn't know it at the time, I can now see that, and it's something I'm really conscious to try and do when I do ask someone for something, is to look at different ways that I can add value back, even if it's not in a technical sense, even if it's just, you know, energy or you know, grabbing them a coffee or whatever it is. It's ensuring that's a two-way street.
It's really important that I've had some great mentors over my time, and most of them have been very informal, but I've always had the drive to add more value than I take. That's the way I try and address it. But at the beginning, with a mentor or proximity to someone that's successful, relationship is you generally take more than you can get. But if they see you're focusing on trying to give back to them, it'll make it such a better relationship. The other thing is you're right about the giving back in different ways to them. But sometimes just seeing a young person take your advice or your information and then implement it, and then they come back and say, you know, hey, Tess, you mentioned the other day I should do this. Well, I've done it. And that's such a great thing you can do for mentors, because there's nothing worse than people who are in a position that could mentor someone younger, and then someone asks them the question and then they either don't get any feedback or the young person just never implements what they suggest. So it's always got to be try and balance those scales out. So Tess, success. I know we talked about that before, but has your definition of what you'd consider success for Tess has changed over the years?
Yeah, it really has been. I feel like through uni and high school, et cetera, life's on a really kind of easy comparable metric to, you know, your peer group. Everything sort of looks similar. You're all on a, you know, graded on a matrix, et cetera. And then even stepping into the professional world, and it looks like, you know, career progression and, you know, those KPIs that you're working to hit at work, they're all very objective and easy to define. But for me, more recently, it's come back down to that feeling of fulfillment and just ensuring it's not a destination, it's not an endpoint, it's a how much do I enjoy how I get to spend my time is probably my current definition of success. But I'm also open to that feeling evolving too through later stages of life.
I'm sure it will change over time. I know mine's changed dramatically over the years. I think as I've got older, Tess, I've got more balanced. I think I've been able to let go of some things that I would doggedly chase. And, you know, the old saying that when people are young, they'll trade their time for money and old people will trade their money for time. I think that starts to kick in once you get over 30 and then starts to really play. You start thinking, well, what do I want out of my life? Where do I want to be going? And if we could all ask ourselves that when we were younger, we'd be in a much better place. And that brings me to the last question, one of the last questions I've got here, Tess, is, you know, you're 32 at the moment and reflection's a really powerful tool. So what's a bit of advice if you could go back in a time machine now? What would you tell 22-year-old Tess, or alternatively, any 22-year-old person out there in the market at the moment?
Whew, that's an introspective one. I think if I was speaking specifically to 22-year-old Tess, it would be to lose the fear of the word no, both saying it and hearing it. So in saying it, it looks like setting boundaries and being okay with that if something doesn't serve you. But then on the other foot, I feel like there's probably so many things or opportunities that I didn't, you know, go for, or questions I didn't ask, or insights I didn't, you know, press further because I thought, oh, you know, I don't want to bother that person, or who am I to walk up to them and ask that? But in hindsight, and it's something I have to challenge myself with on the daily, it's what's the worst that can happen? They'll say no. So what? Life goes on and it's going to go on anyways. So I guess being a little, I'm not sure if confidence is the word, but I think a little bolder in asking for what you want, because if they say no, that's okay. You weren't going to end up with it by not asking anyways. In a broader sense, probably something I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to do is to have a very expansive network through, whether that's through programs, through peer groups, or by just being curious and being that, you know, pesky person who asks a few questions, even though in hindsight I haven't asked all the ones I wish I could, but seeking to get to know the basics of other industries. And just, I might have absolutely no interest in, oh, what industry could it be? It could be in the canola industry. But if you're catching up with someone who says, hey, I grow canola in Victoria, get to know their industry. And just that perspective, which the Nuffield program has really given me so much access to, is you just, in sitting talking to someone, it might not be the technical aspects of growing canola that you get a whole lot out of, but maybe it's their producer co-op networks that you can gain inspiration from. Maybe it's their fertilizer programs or their export protocol. There's just so much opportunity for cross-pollination from different industries, that being curious and just asking people, you know, about their world, even if it has no relevance to your level of interest, realizing the value of that at a younger age, I think could have really expanded my horizons.
I think curiosity is a great piece of advice. I know when I was back, I started my financial advice business well over a decade ago. I was in a business coaching group and there was all different sorts of businesses there. There was a couple of financial advice practices. There was plumbers and there was, you know, hospitality companies and construction businesses. And I used to learn the most listening to the people that were outside my industry that had nothing to do with financial advice. You know, the problems they dealt with, the way they looked at life, the way they ran their business. It was such a great eye-opener. I used to really enjoy that. And if I hadn't been exposed to that situation, I would never have believed it.
I feel like you can ask clearer questions or get a less, I guess, influenced view of an industry when you come at it as a complete rookie or with no reference point. It's amazing how with industries you're familiar with, how many preconceived ideas you bring to the context.
Yeah. And it also can add value, Tess, to the other person as well, because if you're having a conversation about their industry, they're telling you things. Number one is you can ask questions, because you know, if you don't understand the industry, you're technically a dum-dum in their space. You don't know what you're asking. So you ask probably the questions that are really important. And I know I like to be really curious, and I like to ask the what I call the dum-dum questions. I don't understand, so can I ask this question? And sometimes they look at you and go, I never thought about it that way. I don't know why we do this. Or they give me some sort of insight. So there's also some value for the person on the other side as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So what we'll do now, Tess, is we're winding up for the end. So this is the question that I like to ask all my guests, and I'm really, really curious to hear what yours is here. But what's your definition of true wealth?
Oh, good question. I mean, I immediately want to go to, you know, not materialistic, but material things, like, you know, whether it's land, is it time, is it compounding? But I think for me, it's about fulfillment and getting to spend the hours of the day how you want. You know, like, is it you've been in front of a desk working a 9-to-5, but you'd really prefer to be working outside? Or I guess I've spent a lot of my last decade in chillers and cold rooms and in gum boots and abattoir whites and grading carcasses at 2 a.m. And now I love that I get to put on jeans every morning and cowboy boots instead of, you know, like I said, abattoir whites or high heels. So for me right now, it's at home in work clothes and getting to saddle up a horse in the afternoon and go for a ride. It's getting to, spend your time how you choose. That feels like wealth to me.
Look, that's fantastic. You know, that's a common theme I hear right across everyone. It's the manufacturing or getting yourself into a position where you can choose to do what you want to do. And when I say want to do, I don't mean just sitting around watching television or drinking pina coladas on the beach, because people can do that for about an hour and then they're bored. But it's actually being able to be in a position where you can choose the path you want to do in life. And to be frank, Tess, I've seen plenty of people over the years that have made lots of money and built lots of wealth, but have ended up building themselves a set of golden handcuffs and got themselves in the position where they were miserable because they felt like they had no choice or they didn't get to do what they wanted to do during the day. So I think that's a great definition, and you're definitely working hard towards it. And if you're it, you've managed to work your guts out and be curious and be tenacious enough and resilient enough to manufacture that by 32. Mate, imagine what it'll be by 42.
I'm looking forward to it, Ben.
Awesome. Well, look, thanks very much for joining us today. I enjoyed that, Tess. Good luck with the wedding in a few weeks. Yeah, and can't wait to have you back on again some stage.
Thanks, Ben. It's been really fun.
Well, I'm sure you'll all agree, Tess is an amazing woman, and I'm sure she'll be a great mentor to the next generation of women coming through in ag. Now, before we finish this episode, I've got a couple of key takeaways I wanted to go back and just run over again. Number one, the value of a solid network and the fact that even if you aren't born into a quality network, then you need to go out and create one. That was super important and seemed to be a great impact on Tess's journey. Number two, failure's just feedback and it's the best way to learn. If you aren't failing, then maybe you aren't pushing yourself hard enough. Number three, get comfortable with no. That's a great bit of advice from Tess, and it took me a long time to deal with it, but you need to do that as soon as you possibly can. Number four, not having a crack might be the greatest risk in your life. Number five, curiosity is a superpower. The more curious you become, the more successful you'll become. And finally, the one I really enjoyed was, if you enter an operating theater halfway through an operation, it would look just like a murder scene. Now, sometimes in life, things might not be going the way you want, or you might feel like not really succeeding. But in reality, you just might not be at the finish line and you need to get refocused and go on. So I think those were some great points that came out of there for me. Now, before you go, I just want to give you one thing to do right now, and it has to be a step towards improving your life. And I think the number one thing I want you to go and do is, you need to remember you're the average of the five people you surround yourself with. Now, that can be family, friends, it can be employees, it can be professional advisors, whatever it is. So what I want you to do is do an audit of your network and work out who the five people you're most close to or you're taking advice from. And remember, You can't soar with eagles if you're surrounded by turkeys. Make sure you've got the right people around you. And if you don't, go out there and try and build your network of high quality driven people that want the best for you. So that's it for now. If you enjoyed the episode, you can do me a huge favor by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. But best of all, you could pass on the episode to one of your family and friends and share the wealth and wisdom. I'm Ben Law. I'm your host. And I'll see you next time.